Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Kirk Magu. I'm also the Public Relations Officer of the United National Congress, the official opposition party in the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago, and a former lecturer at the University of the West Indies, both at the Jamaica and Trinidad campuses. Today, my guest is Stephen Boucher, co-editor of the book, The Routledge Handbook of Collective Intelligence for Democracy and Governance, published in 2023. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you. Thank you, Kirk.
Yeah. Could you tell us what your book is about?
So the Routledge Handbook of Collective Intelligence for Democracy and Governance, I guess much of what it talks about is on the label, is on the... it's a handbook, academic handbook that explores the concepts, methodologies, and implications of collective intelligence for democratic governance. And it's actually the first comprehensive survey of this field.
Right. So can you explain what collective intelligence is?
Yeah, great question. It's the amazing capacity that groups have, under the right conditions, to outperform individuals in solving problems, innovating, predicting, being creative, and other cognitive tasks. So it's essentially the ability of groups, again, under the right conditions, to do whereby 1 + 1 might be more than 2.
Right. You know, it's like, I guess it's kind of like related in some sense to the Durkheimian sense of society being something different. And I think, you know, other... you know, theorists like maybe Jung, and this idea of a collective identity existing, first of all, which is different from the kind of liberal knowledge of just, you know, understanding that there are only individuals. So this idea. So I suppose it's obvious in the sense that something like collective intelligence would help democracy and governance when you understand it in that way. What are the ways, I'm interested, like, what are the ways that you harness this collective intelligence? Is it things like, you know, I guess currently there's, you know, voting, surveys, I guess now with big data, you know, gathering stuff like through social media, the way Facebook and these companies do it. Is it something more than that or different or what?
Well, we all do collective thinking by default as a species. It's something we're very good at. But we also have a lot of examples of collective stupidity around us, don't we? So collective intelligence doesn't emerge automatically when you put people in the same room or interacting in one way or another. And it also doesn't emerge naturally in the context of politics, where you have a lot of competition, competing interests, competing views of the world, etc. And on the other hand, you also see amazing cases, which this handbook documents, of people who purposefully design their interactions to be smarter together, which, by the way, happens to be the name of the nonprofit we put together to disseminate the principles we talk about in this handbook. And essentially, this happens in many different ways across different contexts. And we actually document, you know, we have 36 case studies with different methods. But what unites them is a number of universal principles. One is that you tend to have great intelligence if you have more people in the room. You know, if it's just you and me trying to solve climate change, well, we might agree fast, but we might have a difficulty.
I guess that's like the idea of brainstorming and whatnot. In a sense, is
brainstorming
it,
or... is a collective intelligence right. method, indeed. So more people, but not just more people for the sake of more people. It's more diverse people who have different views of the world. Another key principle is enabling these people to have a proper exchange of information when it comes to politics, you know, a deliberation versus an aggressive debate, whereby people will, you know, at deliberation, consider things properly, et cetera. So these principles are quite universal.
Right. You know, one thing that's coming to my mind as you're speaking is that you talked about collective stupidity. It's like the opposite, you know, the mob, right? So we have the wisdom of crowds on the one hand, but you also have mob mentality and, you know, and people talk about this. I remember reading, Orlando Patterson talking about like lynchings in the United States and how this mob mentality would take over normally sensible people. So how does this relate to, collective intelligence? Is it that, I'm trying to think, is collective intelligence a series of techniques, or is it something like just a description of a phenomenon?
Collective intelligence is both a process and a field of study, right? As a process, again, you have a number of key principles.
Mm-hmm.
More people, more diverse people, deliberating well, with mechanisms to aggregate their thinking appropriately, and the ability to extend their thinking with greater tools for thinking, and all of this with psychological safety. So if you take the reverse of this, you can have the conditions for group thinking and lots of perverse effects that will amplify people's cognitive biases, people's prejudices, etc. So if you have a smaller number of people with less diversity, you know, sharing similar views, they will reinforce their biases. If you have people not deliberating well, but screaming at each other, or, you know, following the person in the room with the strongest voice, if you don't have psychological safety, you have pressure, et cetera, then you can have these amplification effects and people will start, you know, following the mob. So that is now also science. There's academics from the fields of social psychology, neuroscience, political science, behavioral economics, et cetera, that are studying how groups think better under the right conditions. And collectively, that's, you know, the science of collective intelligence. So that is now well documented. And we can start thinking, well, purposefully, how can we apply this to government rather than just design government, you know, hoping that it will solve problems miraculously?
Yeah, now that, you know, you point that out, that idea of individual safety, I think, is extremely important. And that's what the parliamentary system was supposed to do. And that's why you have freedom of expression. So each parliamentary representative is supposed to have that sense of security that they can speak, they will have time to speak, their views will be considered. And in practice, might be different, but that's certainly the idea there. Your book has examples from all around the world would you say it's these are examples where specific techniques have been used and you're looking at those techniques, or is it where a kind of post facto analysis of a decision making event that was determined as being, you know, collective intelligence. Can you just explain that?
Well, yes, maybe, and I see I could answer better the previous question. So it's a bit like the toolbox and the physics behind the toolbox.
Right.
We understand the physics behind the effect that a hammer has on a nail, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can have that same effect with other tools on a nail. Same here, the science of collective intelligence tells us that there are these key principles. The techniques vary a lot.
Right.
And in the handbook, you have things like the small town outside Copenhagen that developed something that they called political task committees. So it's working groups of elected officials working with citizens to solve public problems in a certain way. That is different as a technique from, for instance, a device in India whereby citizens are invited to share their opinion on public problems through their mobile phones, and they leave messages and they can listen to other people's messages and they can have a conversation like this about a public problem and share their thoughts without necessarily being literate, without having a computer or anything. These are very different techniques. Just name two of them out of the many in the handbook. But they have these principles in common.
Yeah. What would you say? I mean, you're a co-editor of it, and there it's over 500 pages. You have many examples from all around the world, that very diverse, from rich countries to poor countries, large countries to small countries. What are some of the outstanding examples that stick out in your mind, that especially for someone who might be now learning about this, that you think would be great things that would pique their interest?
Well, it's difficult to choose, and I wouldn't want to
choose your favorite
upset
child,
any of the contributors, but there are indeed 70 contributors and 36 case studies. So I will not list all of them. And there are, by the way, not just examples of phenomenal results. There are also examples of failures whereby, I'll start with an example of a failure. A government agency in the southern region of Belgium tried to organize a hub for policymakers called Co-Intelligence Wallonia. That's the region.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't succeed for very long because the principles of collective intelligence were not being sufficiently supported by the politicians. And, the power struggles don't always sit very well. The principles of collective intelligence don't always sit very well with the power struggles.
Mm-hmm.
But now, to give examples of things that worked really well, so again, the political task committees in Denmark, I could cite a forum that is not very well known in Germany called the Agora Energiewende. So it's an agora inspired after the Greeks, that brings together the key players for Germany's energy transition out away from nuclear power. So it's a space that's been designed to enable these very powerful players, industry players, environmental NGOs, government, et cetera, to talk and resolve problems. Whereas normally they would just have these fights over the media and not come to any agreement. Other great examples are like VTaiwan, which is a process both online and offline, whereby the government of Taiwan involves its citizens to address everyday problems, and it was put to use very effectively during the COVID pandemic, for instance, to decide on the number of masks required and how to allocate them most efficiently, to make predictions, to set the agenda for to address the crisis, whereas other countries were seen as not involving citizens very well. In the case of Taiwan, did that very well. So these are three shining examples.
Good, thanks. When you raised the COVID-19 policy making, and there are a couple of articles at least in your book talking about that, and there's a lot of controversy, debate, discussion around that whole process, and there are many people who see big data and I suppose collusion and collaboration between media and the government and pharmaceutical agencies and as trying to control people's thoughts, and on the surface claiming that they want to understand what people are thinking so they can make better decisions, so those in authority can make better decisions, but in reality many want to use that to control and manipulate. How does that relate to the whole theory and study of collective intelligence? Are these things that are on your radar in terms of, you know, the discipline and practice, I suppose, of this emerging field of study?
Mm-hmm. Well, the COVID pandemic is a very interesting case because, indeed, and rightfully so, many people were unhappy about how governments restricted some certain liberties, monopolized the definition of the public agenda, imposed solutions, etc. So it was not very good for democracy on some level. On the other hand, if you compare how, as a society, in fact, at the global level, we tackled this major challenge relative to how humanity tackled the Spanish flu in 1918-1919, well, we had far fewer deaths. There were 500 million in 1918-1919. We came up with vaccines, which some didn't like, but, you know, a cure for this at record speed. And basically, one of our, if you take a step back and you think of government as a brain, as one of our contributors invites us to do, as a society, the different functions of a brain were more effectively handled in this century than they were a century ago. The ability first to observe, you know, what's happening, collecting indeed data, big data, if you want, large amounts of data, making sense of them, you know, in a period when things were very chaotic, changing all the time, uncertain, etc. Making decisions, acting on those decisions, evaluating, remembering what's been done, etc. These cognitive functions were organized in very effective ways. We have the ability today to think as a society much faster. So again, acknowledging the limitations, and we need to be much better in the future at getting even more diversity in that process. There are a number of governments actually that are thinking, when the next pandemic comes around, how could we involve citizens better in the management of such a crisis? So it is, I think we've made progress, and we can make further progress.
Right. Now, you are the CEO of Dreamocracy, is that correct?
It is.
Right. And that is connected to this project, correct?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you explain that a little more? So, like, what Dreamocracy is about and how this book is related to that?
Absolutely. So we are a consultancy. If the listeners are interested, you can go to dreamocracy.eu on the web. And our mission is to help public authorities or anybody shaping public policies to come up with better solutions collectively. Our motto is collective creativity for the common good. So basically, as a consultancy in a field that is complex, my inclination has always been to be able to take a step back and study what we're talking about. And you know, collective intelligence is a buzzword, and it can be understood in very many different ways. And it can be a few quick, easy techniques to, you know, with post-its on the wall. But as we show in this handbook, it is also a science with a huge diversity of approaches, which is very much at its beginning. And behind this, there's a sort of a democracy R&D approach, research and development. We really think that democracy being challenged around the world is the answer to lots of our public problems, but we need to take its ability to solve these problems very seriously. So we won't solve it with a few gimmicks. We won't solve it with a few post-it notes or even citizens' assemblies. We need to enrich our toolbox and capitalize on the things we've learned over the past few decades. That's the mission we set upon ourselves. On the side, we created this nonprofit, Smarter Together, and there anyone can go and access all this material for free, the handbook and others. The address is smarter-together.org.
Right, because this book is open source and anybody can access it. Right?
Mm-hmm. That's it. Thanks to the foundation, Porticus, that gave us a grant to enable all this.
Excellent. Yeah. So yeah. Well, I mean, so you mentioned that. I mean, so the times we're in right now, it's like a new Cold War is emerging. Democracy, in the Western democracies and outside, is challenged, being questioned. And so, how do you see collective intelligence in that context? It sounds like maybe you want to renew and redeem, I suppose, some of the flaws and criticisms that some critics have jumped on or emphasized. Is that a good understanding, or how would you put it?
Yeah, absolutely. The way I see it is, citizens are rightfully so demanding of their governments. And, political scientists talk of three types of legitimacy. People are looking for the legitimacy of their governments through the actions they take and the impact they have on their lives. Basically, if governments solve their problems, great. That government is legitimate in my eyes. That's often not enough. Also, people expect governments to make decisions in a way that is seen as appropriate. The process was transparent, inclusive, etc. So that's called process legitimacy. And one aspect of this process is the ability that governments demonstrate that they listened to people's inputs. And not all governments do that. Now, I would add to that input legitimacy the emotional aspect that citizens feel that their government's decisions are legitimate if they see that governments have listened to their deeper fears, aspirations, etc. So on these four dimensions, impact legitimacy, process, input, and emotions legitimacy, many governments do not have the trust of their citizens today. And if you look at the conditions I mentioned earlier for collective intelligence to emerge, well, you see that it can really answer these dimensions, can help make smart decisions. It requires being more inclusive and listening to people appropriately, including at a deeper level. So collective intelligence done well, treated seriously, is a cure for this trust issue. But of course, on the other side, we face people who have ready-made, easy, simplistic solutions. So that's why I think collective intelligence needs to be taken very seriously, mastered, and the principles and the methods spread so that it is an antidote for the ills of democracy we're seeing, populism, polarization, and so on.
Okay, well, great.
Makes sense?
Yeah, it does. We're coming to the end of the interview, so I want to give you a chance to give a final summary of the book and its importance and its contribution, or and maybe any other work or projects that you're involved in. Why don't you tell our listeners right now?
Thanks, Kirk. Well, that book was designed to be both academic, so seriously sourced and referenced and very readable. So all the chapters are short. They all have stories at their hearts. So there's a lot of inspiration there. So I encourage the readers, and it's all free on the internet. Now, I'll also leave your listeners with thought. In a day and age when autocratic regimes, China, Russia, and others are saying we can be much more effective and democracy is chaos. Well, I would say autocratic regimes have throughout history shown their ability to make very effective decisions that can be very wrong. Whereas democracy and collective intelligence can look very messy, but the probability of making mistakes is much lower, and the probability of being close to what people want and making smart decisions is much higher. So inspiration to go the hard way, democracy for better results for everyone, I think is, I hope, the lesson for everyone here.
Great. Well, thanks so much for this interview. It's been really informative and enjoyable.
Thank you, Kirk. Same here, and good luck. Thanks for listening.
So once again, the book is The Routledge Handbook of Collective Intelligence for Democracy and Governance, and we've been speaking to one of the co-editors, Stephen Boucher. Thanks for listening.